The Lowdown Chronicles. Meet your maker.
So now we are back at Lowdown Podcast, this time with none other than Arison Huge, founder and creator of Acronym Clothing. Hi, Arison.
What's up? Thanks for having me.
How are you these days?
Good. I just got vaccinated, so feeling like light at the end of the tunnel from this entire... I mean, I'm sure it's still going to take a while, but it did feel like a significant change. Like, finally...
So are you looking forward to travel again?
Yes and no. I mean before lockdown I travel like way too much, and like on the road like 6-7 months of the year probably sometimes. And then when the first lockdown happened, like in the beginning of 2020, that was the longest I'd stayed still for, I don't know, over 10 years. And I was like, wow, this is actually great. I can have a routine. I don't have to, like, you know, stress out about like how many more days I have to do whatever. But then, of course, now, you know, a year and a half later, there's places I would definitely like to visit and people I'd like to see and all that stuff. And when you live that kind of lifestyle for that long, like all my friends are distributed around the world, you know, like, which makes it kind of odd. But, you know, thank God for Zoom and FaceTime and whatever. Yeah,
true. What would you say, are you more productive or inspirational productive when you are on lockdown and at one place, or do you get more inspired by traveling?
That's a good question. I think it's different, actually. I get different kinds of inspiration from both. Obviously, traveling is great, but, you know, I'm always amazed at the amount of stuff I can learn and find on Instagram. Like, you know, there's always some, you know, interesting new thing that that pops up. Obviously, a lot of it's garbage too, but I'd say there's different types of inspiration. It's, I mean, traveling, you know, you get all of the incidental stuff, like how do the taxis work here? How does this, you know, do people use cash or do they use, you know, only Apple Pay or whatever? I always find that stuff super cool, but like I said, you can deep dive on, you know, YouTube videos and Instagram and whatever, and find an incredible amount of stuff that you just wouldn't normally. So
if you like talking about Instagram, and if you see Instagram, it's like kind of a mood board as well.
Find
all that stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think this the generation now, you know, all of us growing up, or all the people who have grown up with social media existing, like from Go, I mean, they must be exposed to more images than any time in human history, right? And so visual literacy in that respect is just off the charts. For me, it's just like, I don't really use it as a mood board in terms of like creative, like my work with Acronym design stuff. I'm more like into weird, look at all these weird, you know, knife videos, or here's this crazy dude in China doing, you know, nunchucks super fast. You know what I'm saying?
Which brings me to a good question. What's your biggest addiction?
My biggest addiction right now is probably Instagram. No, I'm going to say sleeping is actually my number one. I love taking naps.
That's a very good answer. I love it. That's a very good answer.
Yeah, I'm all about. I would nap all the time. I don't have a sofa in the studio at the office, because if I did, it would just be like, I'd just be there all the time.
Arison out of order. So, how do you grow up? How early you got in touch with rain, cold, and snow?
Right away. Pretty much instantly. Grew up in Canada, in northern Canada, and was born in a place called Winnipeg, which is like literally the middle of nowhere. But grew up formative years like in a place called Edmonton, which is like, I don't think there's even a million people now, but relatively far north. So winter was like, you know, minus 30 plus wind chill. That was pretty normal. I had a 10-minute walk to school. And by the time I would arrive, I would have like icicles from my, you know, eyelashes. And you could break your scarf because it was just frozen solid. You couldn't feel your toes, you know, like, so you de-thaw and stamp everything out. And yeah, so that, I didn't realize that until much later. They're like, that probably influenced the work I do.
Yeah, but were you, you had an older brother? Who like, or how did your family in general influence your interests? Like, for example, in martial arts or at that stuff?
Yeah, I had a younger brother, actually. He's 2.5 years younger than I am. Harlan, who lives in LA now, he's a software designer. He's like fitter, smarter, younger. I'm only tall. He's richer too. I'm only taller. That's it. That's all I got. But yeah, we grew up together very closely. On the creative side, my parents, that was a huge influence actually, because they had my dad is an architect, my mom is an interior architect, and they had their small studio for most of the time was part of the house. So the house was sort of divided in two and you could go through one door and then you'd be in the office. So we used to go over there, like nobody was in the house. We were just always at the office and messing around on the blueprint machine and, you know, playing with all the gear. And so that fully, that type of like living and working as one, that was already, you know, since I was like,
so
small, yeah.
There was a lot of techie stuff in the house when you were young?
I guess you could say that, yeah. I mean, we definitely had like a fax machine before, like, this is like how old I am, a fax machine before anyone else, you know?
The same age, yeah.
you know, like my dad had email, you know, in the 90s, you know, when it used to cost money to send each email. And yeah, so there was lots of equipment around, CAD software, there's a plotter. Yeah, plus my dad was just always into like computers. And so, you know, that all started, I remember he took my brother and I out to the computer store, which was a thing back then. Galactica Computers, I still remember the name. And we got an Apple II Plus and brought it home and we're like, okay, what are you supposed to do with this? it's not like today where, you know, like it didn't do anything. You know, it was like you had to literally, I don't know how many programs you could have bought to run on it straight, but like it's not like today with the App Store or whatever. But that was the introduction to computers and technology. And you know, obviously that my brother was definitely more, that was more in line with his way of thinking and whatever, and that's the path he followed. But I was always around. I always felt that I knew my way around that stuff until I moved out, and my brother wasn't there anymore to like solve everything. that's when I realized, hey, I didn't learn anything actually.
I mean, you've done pretty good so far. So
yeah, I had other skills, I guess. in the end, you know.
and what brought you to Germany at the end?
Germany was, so I went to university in Toronto and studied fashion design at a place called Ryerson. I was the worst student probably ever. Almost got expelled twice. Multiple run-ins with all the teachers, whatever. I was also like had an attitude problem. I just wasn't the best, healthiest human at the time. And then anyway, Canada had like a recession when we graduated. And there was like, you know, no jobs, nothing to do. I don't think, like the amount of people that work in the industry that graduated from that year is like, I'm sure it's less than 1%. Like nobody, there's no industry in Canada, or not, none to speak of, on any kind of like scale. You pretty much have to do it yourself. It's better now, but back then it was like, this is pre-internet. So there's literally, you know, you got all your information from magazines and everything came from somewhere else. And anyway, so all of that, graduating, was super depressing. And my girlfriend at the time was like, all right, I'm going back home, which was Germany. And I was like, I never been to Europe. I'll come with you. and that's it. And then just showed up with like, you know, $700 Canadian and then there was a recession in Germany as well. That was funny too. So, and then she ended up going off to study Japanese actually in Tübingen, at the Universität there. And then, so that also didn't work out as far as jobs and stuff like that. But yeah, and then just stuck around, tried to learn German, you know, painted fences, taught English, did like whatever. And first industry job was actually in the warehouse, like packing stuff in boxes at some sports company. I can't even remember the name of now, but like had to get up at like, I think 4 or 5 a.m.
Wow.
Like,
what sports company was that?
It was literally a warehouse job. Like there was nothing, you know, like, you know, try and peek in the box and see like the stuff. that was kind of it. It was crazy. But yeah. And then, so we struggled along with all this stuff and tried to make things happen. Eventually I started designing stuff for like local snowboard brands. And I'd always been interested in the technical side of things, also in school. But, and then, yeah, so then when I saw my first like snowboard jacket, I was like, oh, this is super interesting. It does all this stuff. And back then they were putting like, you know, Kevlar pads on the elbows and padding and the knees and stuff like that, which definitely isn't a thing anymore. But yeah, and long story short, we worked for like anyone who would pay us to do anything for years, until, you know, the frustration was just like, what are we actually spending our time doing, got so big. They were like, all right, you know, if no one else is going to do this with us, let's just do it ourselves. And and that's how we started Acronym. And yeah, it took a lot longer than we thought to actually make it into like a real company or brand or a business where you could actually just survive on, you know. And for years we were just doing whatever freelance gigs we could get that would pay for, you know, everything. And then all the money we made with that, we'd stick into the brand and try to grow it and try to, excuse me, try to make, make products.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we are at Acronym right now, and I mean, in my mind, you changed the whole game with bringing up Acronym, because you somehow bridged the gap between the outdoor snowboards technical scene, I would say, like the padding and kneeing stuff you just said,
yeah,
and then brought it totally into the streetwear section.
Yep.
So talking about Urban Warrior or like the City Tech Urban Soldier stuff. So yeah, this is like, when I'm looking at your work, I mean, I see a lot of super forward thinking, future minded ideas. Sometimes it's just mechanical stuff.
Yep.
Do you feel the same, or is this stuff you bringing into your clothing there forever, like for the last 100 years, nobody used it? Or how do we?
I would say it's both, actually. I would say on the material side, we look towards like the newest, you know, latest technologies. But then a lot of the times, actually, contrary to what people sort of assume, we on the manufacturing side will tend to use like very traditional methods. And in the end, we're actually like, we don't care where it comes from. We're like solution agnostic, I guess, let's call it that. So as long as it works, we'll take it and try to use it to do something that that we couldn't do before. So if that's the, you know, Middle Eastern ethnic dress, like, or tracht, or whatever you want to call it, or if it's, you know, something from the military, or it's a tailoring technique, we kind of don't really care where it comes from. It's, and we have a lot of fun researching all that stuff. Yeah.
So was your brand meant to be into the streetwear section or used by like urban consumer or?
Yeah, I guess even when we started, it wasn't as clearly defined as it is now, I would say too. Like streetwear wasn't like this massive force that it is now. Like nobody saw like all of our generation, you know, all the people who started stuff back then, you know, now they're like, some of them are listed on the stock exchanges in Hong Kong and like, you know, or like have sold companies for billions of dollars, right? That was never on the horizon, right? It was just you making stuff for yourself and for your friends, and that was kind of the main thing. But Acronym, I'm like, now I would say yes, it's streetwear, but when we started, it also probably wasn't, because it was way too expensive, right? So we were too, you know, too expensive for streetwear, too technical for fashion, too stylish for outdoor, right? So it was, we didn't fit into any of those categories, which is one of the reasons it took us so long to grow, because, you know, people just didn't know what to do with us for a very long time, right? And yeah, so we're just really stubborn, I guess is what it comes down to. We're like, had this idea that we want to have this type of abilities built into our stuff, and like, and just not have to worry about the clothes, and not have to, like, you know, we want the gear to take care of you rather than you have to take care of it. But you also still want to look presentable or express yourself in a certain way. So the aesthetics are equally important. And I guess that's just never really happened. I guess in the design world, you know, the designers that I meet, they almost always have, or in the past anyway, have almost always had, it's an either or thing, where they either have the skill set to do the aesthetics, which is remarkably complex intellectually, or they have the skill set to do the engineering, which is also remarkably complex. And they're both sort of worlds in themselves, in and of themselves. And it's a different mindset. So to get those two things to work together, I guess people just hadn't really felt the need to do it, or had the time or the will to pursue that. And but we did. That's what we thought was cool. And yeah, it took, like I said, it took a while for people to come around. But when they, now that they have, it's really helped, because it just sort of legitimized all the stuff that we were doing before. And I think it's going to continue that way now, especially with people looking at the, how, you know, ecologically, you know, the state of the world, and realizing like, okay, infinite growth isn't a thing, you know, it's, we live in a planet with finite resources, and we shouldn't just be making stuff just because we can, or just for the money, or just for, like, you know, good numbers on the quarterly report. So I think building things, you know, more purposefully and more meaningfully is going to be more and more important. And that definitely helps us, because, you know, when you do things the way we do, with, you know, the you know, furthest forward possible aesthetics and engineering, you know, it doesn't just take twice as long. It's like, sometimes it's 10 times as long. It's like, it's an order of magnitude more difficult, which is why our collection is always, you know, so small.
Yeah.
I was looking online the other day Mr. Porter. I was online, Mr. Porter, I was looking at Tom Ford. I just clicked all, and there were over 600 Tom Ford products on their one website. I was like,
it is just one season, right?
I didn't go into, I was like, whatever. But I was like, for us to design 600 items, it would take us, you know, literally years. we'll do like our biggest collection is probably 20 pieces, you know?
Yeah.
Whatever. When we're, go to Stode Island showroom or Rick Owens showroom or whatever, and you'll see it's hundreds of things that they make per season. And we just can't do that as much as we would like to be able to have endless variations of stuff or try out all kinds of different things. We always have to decide all right, is this worth spending time on? Are we going to invest into this idea? Because if we do, that means we're going to leave out these other ones. And that's a question of scale for sure, but it's also just because the way we do it, it just takes longer. There's just...
I would say you always almost been on this point, designing so many pieces when you took care of Stone Island, Arc'teryx, and Acronym. And maybe there was some other stuff, maybe some Nike stuff. I mean, this is almost 600 pieces in design, right?
No, it's probably... they were all smaller. Like ACG, we did for Nike. Sometimes that was 7 items, right?
Okay.
In one season.
Yeah.
And Stone Island Shadow was probably the biggest one. That was maybe 35. But so they're all relatively small. And mainly that's because most of the clients that we worked with... they would come to us and ask us, can you do what you do, but for us, right? So using our variables and our infrastructure. And that was great because then we could apply the same principles and ideas, but because you're trying to use the inherent strengths of the company you're working for, you end up with different things and different solutions. And so we learned a lot. That way, always. That was kind of our criteria for why we would do something. If we can learn something, pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, the cool thing you've done with all those brands, and first and foremost, Acronym, your own brand, you created some kind of, I would say in German, Blaupause, which is usable for every jacket or every pant. There's some stuff this fits for every brand, and a lot of brands following you doing that stuff. So, 2 questions. First one is how important is a long-lasting product or circularity in general, the green aspect of clothing in your design? And the second one is another one. When did you realize it's going over the edge with Acronym? When Eric Clapton took the first order, or
that's a good question. Yeah, first question: the circularity thing is obviously hugely important. That is, I think, the challenge of our generation or the next generation as well. And it's such a far-reaching systemic issue that it's going to take all of us, really. Working on it from every possible angle because there's just no easy solutions. And I dislike saying that Acronym is sustainable or circular because it's not, there's no, the problem with all this, it's great that the people's consciousness is shifting and you're seeing the dialogue about environmentally compatible products, but really, the problem with the dialogue now is that there's no standards. There's no governing body that says, yes, this is demonstrably, provably sustainable. Here are the receipts.
Yeah, true.
And so most of the stuff, unfortunately, is still greenwashing. And, none of it is no matter what you do with it, it's the most sustainable thing is just to not make it, right? That's just the truth, right? So with us, what we do is the way we look at it is if we are going to make it, then we really have to believe in it and see a purpose for it. And hopefully there, the thing is that it replaces something that's, less purposeful or more disposable or however you want to call it. What we do is, in a lot of ways, it's the opposite of fast fashion, which for a while, really just dominated apparel economics. And hopefully that's going to go away because it's just the absolute worst in terms of environmental impact, the quality of the clothes, you know, the amount of times people wear them, the kind of dyes they use in the fabrics, the labor conditions of the people who make them. Like, you know, it's I'm pretty sure that apparel manufacturing labor has got to be, it's got to be one of the most exploited labor forces of all industries. And it's one of the biggest ones. It's everywhere, right? Apparel manufacturing is all over the world, in every corner. And yeah, it's that whole, the entire system is ripe for disruption, and it's broken. So yeah, and it's so difficult to propose an alternative to that. Like, it just takes such a long time for people to consciously understand what's going on. But that's definitely happening now. People are coming around. It's like, I think it happened. It's great to see it in food, you know, where people are more aware of, like,
yeah, definitely.
That's the first place I think people understood, like, okay, supply chain is important, not just how it tastes and looks and the price, but like, where did this come from? How is it harvested? What's inside it? And that's the same for anything. I mean, that's the same for the clothes you wear, the products you buy, you know, the car you drive, all of that stuff has this, they all have the same issues. And as we go forward as a society, I think it's boring, and it's not like, you know, it's like, it's kind of a painful reckoning, but that's actually where the real work is now, to dive into that and solve those things. And boring is the wrong word. It's just not Well, my generation, at my age and how I grew up, one of the ways I explained it to somebody else the other day was like, I feel like I finally know how to play the game, or know how to beat the game.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I realized, oh, it's the wrong game.
Or it's the current world we're living in, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just like, wow, okay, so that was... misdirected, you know, the perception doesn't match the reality, right? So, but out of these kind of, you know, confrontations and Auseinandersetzung, you know, that's where the new stuff happens, and that's where the new possibilities come up that we, and I'm sure that'll drive the future. And yeah, so.
Cool.
And then the second question about, when did we, I still feel like Acronym is just reaching the tipping point now. Like, I don't feel like it's happened yet.
Cool.
Because I know what goes on the inside, you know, and the external perception of the brand, for whatever reason is a lot bigger than, you know, what I know is the internal side of it is. So I still feel like we're just getting started, and we are definitely in a better place than we ever have been, that's for sure. But I think people assume that we're just much larger and have more coverage than we actually do. So yeah.
I mean, you have some great clients. I wish I have like Eric Clapton or back then Robin Williams on my list. He's an amazing, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, people just recognized maybe 2 years ago, this was actually geek. He started like wearing it very, very, very intensely.
Super early.
Yeah super early. And all brands.
Now he was, you know, we've all seen the photos of him rocking Bape, like, you know, how many years before Pharrell? And he knew his stuff, man. I actually have a funny story where a guy I knew, Lewis, came to Berlin from the States, and he was doing some stuff here. He was a great guy, but he went back to New York for a while, and he was like, he sent me this text message once, you know, I hadn't seen him for a while, and he's like, yo, I was just with Robin Williams' son, and his dad sent him a package, and he opened it up, and it was a fucking Acronym jacket inside.
Oh, cool. Dad.
And you know, this is way before, you know, Nike collabs and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You really had to know, you know your shit to actually even know that we existed. And I was like, wow, that's really that's wild. Like, that's wild.
That's a cool story.
Yeah. And that's definitely easily the coolest thing about the work is the people that you get to meet because of it. And it's also the most surprising. You just, you know, people that I would never have thought you would even know what we do. They're fully into it and collecting and, you know, hardcore fans. And yeah, it's amazing. That's easily the best part about the job.
Cool. Yeah. Sometimes, like, there is a few, like, soccer players, when I saw them at the stadium live, it was like Franz Beckenbauer, when I saw him the first time, like, really standing, like, 2 meters besides me in, like, a VIP stuff at the Berlin Olympic Stadium. I was there with Foley, and, like, we both shaking. That's him.
Like, whoa.
Wow. That's him.
He's real.
Do you have this moments with some people?
Let me think. Yeah, I mean... The one that comes to mind right away is I was sitting in a car. We're in Berlin, and my phone rings. It's my Motorola Razr rings. It's like that's how long ago it is. and I pick up. I'm like, hello, and then the voice on the other side is like, is this Errolson? I'm like, yeah, and I'm the whole time I'm thinking like, I know this voice. Like, who is this? Like. And says, yeah, hi, this is Eric. I'm like, Eric, who's Eric? And he's like, I got your number from Hiroshi. And like, now I'm like, I'm even more confused, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what's going on? Anyway, I'm on tour and I'm going to be in Berlin on Saturday. And would you be around? And is it okay if we come to the shop, you know? and then it turned out it was Eric Clapton. And that was wild. That was just like,
this is cool.
What the hell?
Sorry, Eric, what shop do you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he came by Firmament. That was also the first time I saw like rock star shopping, which was really cool. He was just like, size medium. And basically just took everything that was in size medium and put it in a box and it was like, thanks.
See you at the concert. Like, you've been to the concert afterwards?
Yeah, and he invited us. He was super gracious and took care of us and, you know, went to the concert and, you know, VIP, backstage, champagne, the whole thing. It was just like, this is crazy. And yeah, he's such a chill guy. He's such a cool dude. Anybody who's dealt with him will tell you. I had another funny Eric Clapton experience. I've only met him twice. Three times. We were supposed to go to it was a Visvim party, actually. It was a Visvim party in LA, and I got the address totally wrong. Like, back, this is MapQuest days, so before Google Maps, you know, and we're like on the wrong end of town, like in this endlessly long street in LA. And then figured out, okay, wrong spot, and ended up getting to the party, like dinner/party, like it was already over. I was with my friend Steven. We walk in the lobby, like super deflated from like, you know, an hour of like driving pointlessly through LA and tired out and standing in the lobby, like, is this even the right spot? Like trying to see somebody's, you know, that we recognize. And then from behind us, somebody goes, hey, Errolson, how's it going? And turn around and it's Eric Clapton sitting in the lobby. And I'm like, oh, hey, Eric, what's up? He's like, yeah, have a seat. We're just chatting here. And my friend Steven's like, what is going on? Like, this is Eric Clapton, the greatest guitar player on earth. Yeah, it was super funny. Yeah. So, yeah, Eric, a legend. Yeah.
Cool. I mean, going back to the whole design thing, after gaming laptop,
right?
Actually designing clothes for Hollywood movies.
Yep.
Car project.
Yes.
So is there one, what would be your favorite piece, if you had an option, what would it be?
If I had to pick like favorite, yeah, like collaborative project,
or a thing, like even a watch or a spoon maybe. I don't know.
Like to do next?
Yeah, if you would choose one thing you never got your hands on, what would it be?
Probably, I've been thinking a lot about bicycles recently, actually. Back in the Toronto days in university, we kind of messed around with one of my uncles owns a bike shop, and he's a bike mechanic. And we had messed around with some interesting, like, bike, not designs, but more like modifications. And that was always really fun. And I was just thinking the other day, like, it might be like time to try that again because, now we have obviously more resources and skills. But it also just seems like that's the perfect machine for the future, right? Like,
yeah.
Definitely nothing, you know, concrete yet, but just that's been kind of percolating in the back somewhere. And we have another project that I can't talk about yet that I'm super excited about that should come out in 2023, actually. that'll be a new cool thing. Really, it's I think the most surprising thing for me about the collaborations is that when they work, we pretty much do just sort of what we always do. And it's not like we have to relearn, you know, a whole method of working or anything. Like, people, you know, the great thing about doing something that, like, you identify with and you have your, where you have your own approach, is that when people see it, they're like, oh, we want you to do that. So, you know, even when we're designing stuff, like if we design stuff for film or for video games, we just design it like we're designing a real product, like a real jacket, and then... it's great that, you know, in our case, it translates over into those, you know, fictional worlds. Same with the laptop. So that's surprising and sort of like empowering because you're like, oh, not totally crazy. could keep going this way for a little while longer. There's still possibilities and still things to learn. Yeah.
Cool. How do you get along in Berlin mobile? Do you have a bike?
I do, but it's got flat tires. I just walk now.
And it's not stolen. So
it's not stolen. It's still it's inside. it's safe in the archive. But I just walk every time. Okay, I took a taxi here because I didn't know where it was, and it was a bit further away than I anticipated. But I love walking. Like even when I travel and I go to any other city, I'm usually jet lagged and awake at ridiculous hours. So I always like to just go outside and pick a direction randomly and see what the city is about. But in Berlin, I feel like I'm a tourist in Berlin these days too, because I just haven't been interacting with the city for quite a while. The last couple of years, I've been traveling a lot and working way too much. So when I come back to Berlin, the studio, and I go to the office in the morning and then I leave like 14 hours later. and then I just, my apartment is like, it's a 3.5 minute walk away from the studio. So. And there's like two restaurants that are also about that distance. and that's it. That's how I just stay there. In contrast to when I first came to Berlin, the first couple of years, you know, I'd go out at, you know, three nights a week, four nights a week. there was a period where I started to like, know all of the bouncers at all the different places, and I was like, "This
can we stop this discussion?"
Yeah, exactly.
I think we met.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometime
might have run into each other. So I'm not. Yeah, that's a 180 now. I'm like,
yeah. How do you feel about Berlin in general?
Good. Yeah, I feel good about Berlin. It's
tell us something about your relationship to the city.
I mean, Berlin was super critical for Acronym, for me as a creative person in terms of development, because it was like, I never lived in a city that I identified with ever in my life. Like I was always like from some small town or some place where I just, you know, didn't like anything or anyone, or felt, you know, like felt left out of the entire, you know, scene or community. And Berlin was like one of the first places where it was like, at least when I got here, it probably still is like that, actually. It's one of the few cities where it's like, it's a city on a scale where a lot of interesting things happen and, you know, people come through. But locally, there's a lot of like really strong creativity, but that you don't need like a lot of money to access it.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's like, it's so, that's amazing, right? So if you're, you know, young or you just don't have access or whatever, you know, when I came to Berlin, it was like, I was like, wow, it's not even cool to have money here. Like, it's like, this is incredible. And it's also like, because of the, you know, the economics of the city, you can try something out, right? And you try something out and you put a little bit of money to it and you fuck it up, but your whole life doesn't end, you know, then you're like, okay, that didn't work. I'll try something else, you know? And an acronym, like, there's no other city we could have done what we did, just because of the, you know, the costs involved. I could never have set up the studio in New York or London or LA or anywhere. And I thought about it, you know, or Tokyo, thought about it, I don't know how many times, and would look into it and just be like, there's just no way. And that was instrumental in allowing us to like, also to figure out what we were doing, right? Because, you know, we laugh at our company because we have such an individual way of approaching things, which is our strength, because that means our products and the results of what we do are visibly different from everybody else's, are functionally different as well. But we've also, like, nobody's ever worked anywhere else, so we have no idea, like, how does everyone else do this, right? Like, so we're all self-taught, and it's, you know, for better or for worse. And Berlin as a city allowed that to happen, because it wasn't this, you know, insane treadmill situation where you're just trying to survive, you know? And, you know, I had like a little apartment in Brooklyn for a while. And before that, a place in LA, and I'd go there every once in a while and try and work there and do stuff. But I just realized, like, wow, it takes so much effort to just kind of stay afloat there. And I just wasn't in the position where I was like, okay, I can devote my time to this. I just had too many responsibilities and not enough resources. So it was just like, yeah, it, and Berlin turned out to be the perfect spot for that.
Yeah. So that's true. You can do a lot without any money.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you see it here, 25 years of lowdown.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And at the end of the day, that's what counts, right? It's like, I saw an interview with the guy who's going to play Blade, Mahershala Ali, is that how he says his name? The other day, and he was just talking about creativity, and he was like, you know, all those other people can bring is the money. You know, and I always saw it the other way around. I was like, God, if I only had the money, right?
Yeah.
And when he said that, I was like, he's absolutely right. Like, the money is like kind of, in some ways, is the least important part, because if it wasn't, then every Hollywood movie would be amazing, right? You know, like, and they're all, I mean, they're almost all, you know, like anything, when you see companies throw money at something, it almost never works, right? So, I think that would have helped my sanity a lot if I had realized that when I was younger, like, that actually it's really the creativity and the intention that counts. As hard as that is when you're like struggling to buy groceries and pay rent, you know, but it's still, you know, that is still, I still think that's also why I have no problem with Akron being small, like, you know, where we could have made, you know, tons more money than we have, but and it's good to be financially secure, but you know, most of the decisions that get made by companies, and especially in at least the industry I know, in fashion, it's almost always just about the money, right? And that's which is kind of sad in the end of the day, at the end of the day, right? Because you and you can see it when you pick up the stuff. You're like, oh yeah, the only thing they cared about here was the profit margin,
you know? Yeah. And, some people die hard, like they're pretty trying to get into something, like they definitely want it, and if it's tried too hard, then it doesn't work.
You can tell from the beginning. You can see it doesn't have. There's no soul. There's no authenticity. There's no. It's just not cool. And yeah. So in Berlin now. Yeah, like I said, I feel like I'm going to, well, everybody probably feels like that after the pandemic, but like, get back into like rediscovering everything. Yeah, it still feels, occasionally it feels too small, you know. I've always been into like, you know, bigger cities that just have always fascinated me. Coming from a small town, growing up in a small town, I was always like, yeah, Tokyo, New York, whatever. You know, and now I definitely realized that like having a manageable scale also has advantages, right? And Berlin's like right in the middle. It's got like, it's a small place, but it's not too small. And yeah, and it's just, you know, I would say, you know, when other people describe how they describe cool. Hey, dude, what's happening? Good to see you.
The bus comes in, yes, for the record.
Absolutely. The OG. Yeah, when other people in other cities talk about cool, like Berlin is actually cool, right? And I still think that's 100% true.
Good. One last question. What's on Eris's playlist nowadays?
My playlist. Two completely opposite things I listened to recently. I drove from Munich to Berlin the other day, and for whatever reason, I was like, I didn't have anything on my phone, so I just hit the Drake Essential Mix playlist, and then I was like, whatever, and I drove away, and yo, that the Essential Mix didn't repeat for the entire drive.
Wow. Okay, like, 6 hours, seven hours.
It's over 5 hours long. So that blew me away. I was like, what the hell? And you know all the songs, right? You're like, okay, this guy's written a lot of stuff. And then the other thing I've been into is this band called the Linda Lindas, which are like these mixed race, they're little girls. Like, I think one of them's 9. And the oldest one is like 14, from LA.
Okay.
And they play this like riot girl, you know, guitar music, and they're amazing. It's incredible. Definitely worth YouTubing. They just I think they just signed to a record label recently, and it's so punk rock. It's so cool. It's just like, wow, these kids are like, you know, 12. Like, I will never be this cool.
Yeah, that's, yeah, it. Kids nowadays are,
yeah, it's
like
incredible.
If you see them,
yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's the result of, like I said, just growing up and having access to information and sort of being able to finesse, like, you know, the systems and understand, like, oh, I can suck information out of this, and I can contact this person, and then, yeah, and having the situation where the parents were like willing to let you go off and do all that shit. It's amazing. Yeah.
Cool.
Hope for the future and the next generations.
So. Yeah. Okay. So bicycle companies, if you hear this, we are here. We all need new bikes, and we have a perfect designer here for you. Just like drop us like info@podcastlowdown.com or something. Thanks,
awesome.
Arison.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you very much.